Commvault gets Appy, IBM cache for Cohesity, Meta AI chips are almost ready, Zscaler closing the air gap, SK Hynix is fabulous, VMware perpetual license perpetuated, and a look at Google Cloud Next in this episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Gestalt IT Rundown for Wednesday, April the 17th. My name is Tom Hollingsworth. I am your host for this episode. And joining me, of course, is my wonderful co-host, Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, welcome to the show.
It is awesome to be here, Tom. And before we get started with our usual news coverage, I do have some breaking news to talk about our own company this morning. As you know, Gestalt IT and Techfield, they are part of the Futurum Group. Well, the Futurum Group just announced today, right now, literally, that it's acquiring Techstrong Group, which is the company that produces Techstrong TV, DevOps.com, Security Boulevard, and other sites like that. We are very excited about this because it means that Gestalt IT is going to become part of their tech media offerings. We're going to have a lot more reach, a lot more viewership. If you ever wished that you could watch the Rundown over the top on your smart TV or see us at a live event in person, well, it sounds like you're going to get your chance. So welcome, Techstrong, to the Futurum family.
And we are very happy to have them as a part of all of the great things that we're doing. And Stephen, since we're going to be on TV, I figured I needed to practice some other media offerings. So let me try this. Gliding bat at night, blind but for the sound they see, darkness is their day. I figured it was important because today is not only International Bat Appreciation Day, but it's also National Haiku Poetry Day. And yes, you can count it up. There's the appropriate number of syllables in there. I figured this was more exciting than National Banana Day, unless I go bananas later, in which case, you never know what might happen.
Curving yellow fruit, orange ball, crunch, very tasty. It is also National Cheese Ball Day, Tom.
Well, I'm glad we've got all the foods, the animals, and the poetry going on. So let's dive into the first story, and it has to do with our friends over at Commvault because they are enhancing their capabilities in cloud resiliency by acquiring Appranix, a startup that specializes in cloud application recovery. Appranix was founded in 2016 by Govind Ragaswamy, and it's based in Boston. They quickly restore applications disrupted by outages or cyber attacks, leveraging cloud storage and advanced services. With this acquisition, Commvault aims to merge its risk management and recovery tools with Appranix's cloud-native rebuild technologies, broadening its offerings to include both data and application resiliency. Stephen, you're very familiar with Commvault and their offerings. What is Appranix going to bring them?
Yeah, this is interesting. I didn't really know much about Appranix before this announcement, but of course we follow Commvault pretty closely. And so I took a look at it. It looks kind of cool. Essentially, this is a product that is designed for cloud native applications. And if the application fails, let's say it gets attacked by malware or hacked, or there's just an outage or whatever, Appranix will automatically basically reset all the stuff, make all that cloud infrastructure restart, reconfigure, make sure everything works right. And this is pretty neat because, as you can imagine, a lot of these applications that are running in SaaS have a lot of configuration involved with them. I mean, if your application is running some, you know, cloud instances here and you're using this service and this SaaS and this other thing over here, you know, all that stuff is going to take a little bit to reconfigure, if you even know how it was configured in the first place. And it looks like Appranix Copilot basically does that stuff for you. It keeps track not only of, you know, where you are and how you're configured, but then it'll go back in there and reconfigure it in the event of an outage. This makes a lot of sense as a combination with some of the things that Commvault is already doing, because, of course, data protection is part of a bigger high availability and resiliency story. So again, I wasn't really aware of this product before, but now that I am, I definitely see how it lines up nicely with what Commvault is doing. And I expect similar solutions to be part of the arsenal of many of these other companies in the data protection space. Cohesity has closed their latest funding round, Series F, which was led by IBM. The round totaled $150 million and included other investors you may have heard of, including NVIDIA. This brings Cohesity's total funding to $850 million, and it comes after a blockbuster news that Cohesity was acquiring the data protection side of Veritas. IBM has partnered with Cohesity on the cyber resilience platform, including Cyber Defender, integrating that into Storage Defender. Tom, what does this investment mean coming from Cohesity, and is there any interest from the IBM side?
I think IBM is very interested in this because they have a lot of assets that they need to protect on their storage side. And having a proven player in the market in Cohesity, who is just going to get bigger on the data protection side thanks to this Veritas acquisition, it means that IBM can kind of mold Cohesity to what they need. And this is something that we talked about last week during Security Field Day, is how a lot of companies are trying to double down on, do we develop our own or do we, you know, kind of farm it out, as it were. And we've seen that quite a bit from other companies in the space. I think the most popular one would be Index Engines. I mean, their CyberSense is actually an OEM part of a lot of other companies' data protection offerings. So I imagine that IBM is really going to be looking hard at Cohesity and kind of using them as like that data protection aspect of their defense software. And to talk about the fact that it's a Series F funding round, I know that there are people in Silicon Valley who are probably turning apoplectic over the fact that someone took a sixth funding round. But I don't see it that way. I actually see it as one of the very first rounds of what Cohesity has become. They're no longer a secondary storage company. They're no longer just a backup company. They are, in fact, a data protection company, which means SoftBank is wanting to put more money into them through these funding rounds to kind of develop this technology area. And I see this as a way for them to kind of, you know, augment that and get some big names on the marquee as they continue to develop what data protection will eventually become. So congrats to the people at Cohesity. Enjoy your new money. New desks for everybody. All right, Stephen, Meta is ready to build their next big chip. This comes a year after the announcement of the Meta Training and Inference Accelerator, or the MTIA. Now, the parent company of Facebook said that they are nearing completion of the successor chip, which I'm sure will probably just be MTIA version 2. It's going to double the compute and memory bandwidth of the first version, and the chip is actually going to be powering some of the models that drive ranking and recommendations on the various platforms under Meta's dominion. Now, we've talked a lot about some of the things that AI can help accomplish, and I know that AI is big on the minds of the people at Meta because they're developing their own models to do this. What is the value of having a chip that runs your own model to do the things that you're good at?
Well, certainly there seems to be a lot of value in controlling your own chip destiny. We're actually going to talk about Google's chip announcements a little bit later in the program here. And of course, there's been a lot of talk about Amazon developing their own chips too. Essentially, all the hyperscalers are looking at wringing even more efficiency out of their infrastructure. And also, they're, I think, a little bit nervous about being reliant on third parties. So I was talking to my colleague here at the Futurum Group, Dave Nicholson, about this, and he pointed out that essentially Meta has also announced that they're going to be buying a huge pile of NVIDIA GPUs. Meta said that it's going to obtain 350,000 H100 GPUs by the end of this year. Now, if you're Meta and you're looking at that equipment bill, you might start saying, well, maybe we should be developing our own stuff just to make sure that we're not too reliant on NVIDIA. Not only, you know, not because NVIDIA is bad, simply because everybody is reliant on NVIDIA. And if you're Meta, you don't want to have a strategic error, which was what could happen if you are relying on these shipments of GPUs that you know, maybe could be disrupted by something. So it seems like there's sort of multiple aspects to this story. Number one, of course, they're trying to develop a chip that does exactly what they need it to do. But number two, think about the overall strategic importance of AI. Essentially, none of these companies can afford to fall behind in the AI race, because if they don't have the infrastructure to run their next generation models on, they could lose customers. They could lose footing in the race, and they could fall behind. And if they do that, well, I think most people in the industry are assuming that AI is basically the whole ballgame. If you lose AI, you lose everything. Zscaler is continuing to build out their own zero trust offerings with news that they're acquiring Airgap. The startup was founded in 2019 and uses agentless architecture to identify and isolate devices and apply policies based on the context and their identity. Airgap is reported to be integrated into the Zscaler SD-WAN solution in the future. Terms of the deal were not announced, but Airgap did have a Series A funding round in 2022 that valued at $13 million. This is the second acquisition from Zscaler this year. Tom, I know you're very focused on this area. What's your take here?
I like the fact that Zscaler has recognized that it's not just about securing traffic that is going north-south out of your network bound toward the cloud or to the internet. There's a lot of east-west traffic that needs to be secured as well. And that's one of the problems that we're starting to see with a lot of the more advanced attacks that are kind of breaking down the front door. It's the lateral movement that's really costing people. Ask Microsoft how bad it is when people have the ability to laterally move inside of your network. You might want to wait until the federal government's done raking them over the coals, though, because there was a lot of embarrassment when, you know, they were able to get into email accounts and other things like that. So the key for me here is the fact that Airgap uses an agentless architecture. That means that I don't have to worry about what kind of hardware I'm running, what kind of user operating systems I'm running. Agentless is the way to go because it means that devices are protected as soon as they're connected to the network before anything is installed on them. And it's using the ability to kind of identify these devices and figure out user privilege levels and apply policies intelligently. That means that instead of saying, oh, well, I've got to go in and I've got to lock Steven down as soon as he joins this network, the policies are already in place. So if you don't have a policy that permits you to access a resource, you can't see it. And that is huge because it also means that I can restrict things like service accounts to make sure that they're unable to do things. And I'm sure that when Zscaler starts integrating this into their platforms, the key is going to be that they're going to be able to augment this with additional things like, oh, if this user logs in at a time that they're not supposed to, they're going to see a much different visibility in the network. That's kind of a, you know, way to prevent global hacking teams from being able to get into stuff. We've seen that recently where that has become a huge issue. So I'm excited to see where this goes. Can't wait to hear from Zscaler about all these integrations. I hope that we'll be able to come to Security Field Day very soon and talk about it with our great group of amazing practitioner delegates. SK Hynix recently announced plans to construct an advanced memory packaging facility in West Lafayette, Indiana. Now, this thing is valued at $3.87 billion, and it's the first packaging facility in the United States for the memory giant. It's expected to be up and running by 2028. In a different story, Samsung is set to receive their own CHIPS Act funding, supporting advanced chip manufacturing deep in the heart of Texas. There's up to $6.4 billion in funding available here, not through loans, but through tax credits, according to a Bloomberg article. This does match TSMC, but it trails behind Intel and government manufacturing support. Steven, this sounds like the U.S. really is putting its money where its mouth is when it comes to helping these chip manufacturing giants build facilities here in the U.S. How do you feel about what SK Hynix is doing as well as what Samsung is looking to do?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a big move. Now, if you've been following the rundown, you know that I've been talking about the CHIPS Act for a long time. You know that I've been talking about the manufacturing capabilities of companies like Intel and TSMC and Samsung in the United States. And you know that I've been on about packaging. Because the problem is, if you've got a big fab and you're turning out, etching these wafers and you know, basically, that's not good enough. You need to be able to take those wafers and package them into functional chips. And right now, that means shipping those wafers back to Taiwan, back to South Korea or Japan or even China for packaging. Well, that's not really achieving the goals of independence in chip manufacturing, is it? So it's really nice to see that companies are investing in packaging as well. We talked about that with Intel. They are looking at building a packaging facility here in the U.S. It sounds like Samsung is going to be doing that as well in association with their investment in Indiana. And yes, SK is going to build a dedicated packaging facility here in Indiana to take high bandwidth memory chips and package them and get them ready for production. Now, this is important because, as I said, packaging is one of the key components of chip making, but also packaging HBM is a really interesting angle too. Hynix is leading in the production of HBM. They seem to have been selected by most of the next generation products out there, including NVIDIA. But yet they're having trouble meeting demand, not just because of production, but because of packaging. To such an extent that we're hearing that NVIDIA may be working with Samsung to package Hynix HBM modules in order to ship a next generation NVIDIA stuff, which is kind of mind bending because Samsung makes HBM too, but they weren't selected. So it's all kind of wrapped up together. The bottom line is that the US needs to have advanced chip packaging, not just advanced chip manufacturing. In the United States, if they want to achieve any kind of balance and if they want to reduce reliance on places like Taiwan, where these things are currently done. If this goes much further, I think that we might actually get to a point in a few more years where next generation products can be maybe not 100%, but pretty close to 100% manufactured in the United States. And I think that that will achieve the goals that the administration set out when they proposed the CHIPS Act funding years ago. So overall, I would say that this is a really great move. It follows on to a lot of the stories that we've been covering here on the Rundown, as well as if you pay attention to the 6-5, you'll hear Daniel Newman talking about these things a lot. You'll hear Dave Nicholson and Corey Johnson talking about these things. This is big. And it represents a real strategic shift in terms of onshoring chip manufacturing. The ongoing saga of VMware and Broadcom has a new aspect this week. After months of informing customers that VMware licensing was too complex and not well integrated, which meant big changes towards subscription licensing, Octane has offered a new option. VMware by Broadcom has announced that they'll be officially supporting extensions to some customers that came up for renewal during the changeover and are having issues adjusting to the new subscription model. Also of note is that VMware is announcing that they'll be offering zero-day security patches for supported versions of vSphere, even if support contracts have lapsed. These announcements from the company come on the same day that European antitrust regulators are reportedly asking questions about the new licensing model. Tom, do you suspect that these things are related?
I think they could be. Now, if you hear a little bit of squawking off in the distance, that would be the crow that Hawk Tan is currently being forced to eat by his largest customers. So I want to tackle the second one of his announcements first, which is the fact that they're going to start offering zero-day patches for versions of the vSphere hypervisor, which are technically still supported, even if your support contract has lapsed. We like to call this doing the right thing, because you need to make sure that you are protected against some of the worst of these bugs that come up, you know, like the severity 9.9 out of 10 CVEs. That just means that you're keeping the entire ecosystem protected. That way you can't, we don't have support for this, so we can't patch it. Microsoft learned that lesson, which is why you can still find patches being developed for Windows XP, which runs on a lot of automated teller machines. But I want to go back to the first part, because this is effectively a rejection of the changes by some of those largest customers. We've heard that you're going to have to move to a subscription model. We've heard that, you know, they're making all these huge changes, and we were wondering when the other shoe was going to drop. Well, I think that the customers jumped in and stepped on somebody's foot first by saying, okay, fine, we're not ready to move yet, and you're going to have to wait until we are. And the wording of the announcement was, you know, still very much, we're going to have to do this. It's going to have to change. Nothing is sustainable like this. But we also know that changing from an OPEX to a CAPEX model is not easy. And since we're going to more of an OPEX model and you need time to adjust your accounting for that, we're going to let you have some extension. So my guess, without knowing anything about this, is that they're going to give you maybe one extension, maybe the next point release, or to the end of the calendar year, or the end of the budget year, or something like that. They're not going to just force some of their largest customers to move over. Because you remember back a few months ago when they moved their biggest 2,000 customers to be direct support as opposed to channel partner support? Do you know what you take on when you move all those direct support? You take on all the complaints, all the headaches, all of the issues that those people were already dealing with. And now they're yours. And you don't have a partner in the middle to get yelled at when something goes wrong. So you're getting full force when they're like, we don't like this. You need to change it. We need support. We need to do these things. And the fact that it just so happens to coincide with the European regulators taking a look at all of these makes me wonder if there wasn't a coordinated effort, there was an awful lot of reading the tea leaves going, man, if I make a big stink about it now, VMware is going to have to pivot really fast in order to avoid getting under a lot of scrutiny. Because if VMware had just come down and said, nope, not going to happen, you're going to have to move no matter what, that's just ammunition for the regulators to be like, we'll see about that. So I'm interested to see kind of how the saga plays out. For those of you out there who are hoping for, you know, the perfect solution, I'm sorry to say, you're not going to get your free vSphere back. That's not a thing. It's not going to happen anymore. This is just a way for some of the most affected companies to have a better transition plan. Steven, in order to take a closer look at a story, I must tell you that last week was Google Cloud Next. I don't know if you heard about this or not, considering that almost everybody's eyes were on this huge show, because the hyperscaler was announcing all kinds of neat things like new ARM chips, lots of new partnerships, wall-to-wall AI everywhere you turned. Couple of things that came out of it that I thought were interesting. Google's Vertex AI agent builder allows no-code deployment of agents. Google Vids targets video editing, and the search giant is leaning into retrieval augmented generation, or RAG. Now, I know that RAG is something that is very interesting to you, Steven, so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, let me start with that. And it makes a lot of sense for Google to be leaning into this, as you guys will soon see. So we have been talking about AI for a long time. Remember, we did multiple seasons of our Utilizing Tech podcast focused on AI. We've also, of course, we had a huge AI Field Day event earlier this year. And we're talking about AI to everybody because, of course, that's what everybody's talking about. But one of the challenges with AI is that large language models are essentially, in my opinion, more of a user interface than an actual producer of data. In other words, if you ask a large language model a question, it is going to generate an answer, and it's going to generate an answer based on the data it was trained for, but it's not guaranteed to generate the right answer. Now, one of the things Google is doing, and a lot of companies are doing with these large language models, is essentially giving them tools. If you ask somebody, what's 2 + 2, they'll know that it's 4. But if you ask them, what's the square root of, 1701, they probably won't know. If you give that person a calculator, they'll be able to figure it out. So Google and all these other companies are doing that. They're basically giving their LLMs a calculator. They're allowing the LLMs to use external tools. And one of the most important external tools that LLMs are getting access to is what we're calling retrieval augmented generation. It's right there in the name. If you think about generative AI, well, what does generative AI need to do in order to generate the right answer? It needs to go retrieve it. It needs to go find it. And that's really what we're talking about here. Essentially, what Google is doing behind the scenes is giving their AI LLMs tools and access to more tools, including, yes, Google's engine. I mean, essentially, this is a company that was built on retrieval of data, on queries. And by letting LLMs query information, it makes a lot of sense. This was not really a highlight at Google Cloud Next. It wasn't really something that they spent a lot of time talking about. But as noted by our colleague, Keith Kirkpatrick, who was at the event, there was definitely an undercurrent of RAG throughout the entire event. There was a lot of talk about allowing LLMs to use external data sources, and Google engineers are definitely on board with this concept. If this works, if they can make it happen, then Google's LLMs will be much more powerful because they'll have access to Google, What else did you see there at Google Cloud Next?
So I was very excited about this whole Google Vids idea. Now, hear me out. All right. Everybody who does video editing was rolling their eyes because, oh, it's AI video. But I want you to think about what Google is announcing. You have an AI-powered solution that will allow you to storyboard a video, pick out background music, pick out scene transitions, pick out stock videos, and just from a prompt, say, you know, I want a video that talks about, you know, being outdoors or something, and it will find stock video of those kinds of like outdoorsy type scenes and stitches it all together. You can even add voiceovers using a stock voice or using your own prompts or whatever. Now, again, if you are someone who lives in Final Cut Pro or Adobe Premiere, you don't use this. This is not for you. You already know how to storyboard a video and use all those elements and figure out how to fade out music and stuff like that. This is aimed at people who are not video editors. And I think that there's a lot of value there because I want you to think back to the last time that you had this thought. Man, that's a really great idea. Oh, but I don't want to do it because I'm going to have to figure out all the little details. Well, this is taking care of most of those details for you. You give it a prompt, it will spit out a video, and you can go in and tweak the little bits and pieces that you don't like. You know, this transition needs to be faster or stuff like that. You know, the things that us professionals have spent years learning how to do, only now it's consolidated into a software program. What does this mean for Google? Oh, I don't know. More videos on YouTube? Which is really what they want. This is a way for them to add content to one of their largest platforms, which of course they run ads against, so they're going to get more money out of it. And all it's costing them is the compute power to run these LLMs and algorithms and things like that. And oh, by the way, they're refining those things as they go along because of the user inputs that they're getting for this. Now, the other caveat is this is only going to be available for people who are using paid workspace programs and probably starting in the June timeframe. So for all of those people out there that were like, oh, yay, Google's letting us keep our free workspace like they said they were going to. Yeah, you're not going to get access to the AI video editor. You're going to have to pony up some money for that. Stephen, one of the things that Google announced during Google Cloud Next was their line of Axion processors, because, you know, it turns out that building your own custom ARM processors to run your workloads is the new hotness in the market. And considering all of the things that Google is doing, you know, machine learning, analytics, all of those other things, what is the big value in creating a new processor line? Because we know that they have their Tensor processing units that they use for AI. Is Axion going to give them something different?
Well, yeah, I think that essentially you can look at this, and it's frankly kind of a Me Too move from Google, because you know, Amazon has been doing this for quite a while with their Graviton processors. They announced in the fall that the Graviton 4 would come out, and it uses the Neoverse V2, which is the new ARM server core design. And that's what Axion is doing too. It's using the Neoverse V2. It's very similar in concept to what Amazon is doing with CPUs. Similarly, Google announced what they're calling Titanium, which is an offload engine that would handle certain things like networking and security and storage. And if you think that rhymes with Nitro, well, it doesn't. But it's the same thing as Nitro. Essentially, it's the same concept. You know, Google has their own offload engine as well. So both of these cases, I mean, you can look at Graviton plus Nitro being very similar to Axion plus Titanium, and it is. But that being said, what's going on here is essentially a move by these companies. And yes, others are involved here too. You know, Microsoft is looking at this. You know, everybody is looking at rolling out their own custom chips in order to make sure that they're able to run their workloads most efficiently. We talked earlier in the story, in the episode today about Meta having their own custom chips as well. And just like I talked about then, one of the aspects that I want people to keep in mind here is that it's not just about making custom chips because they don't want to rely on third-party vendors. It's also making custom chips because they want these custom chips to do the things that they want. The power of Nitro is that it does specific things that Amazon needs for Amazon's cloud. And I'm going to guess that the power of Titanium is going to be very similar. Essentially, Google is going to be delivering a custom processor that accelerates the specific workloads that Google's using. Because frankly, a lot of off-the-shelf chips, especially if you look at big complicated chips like Intel x86, well, they have a lot of hardware, silicon in that chip that is probably not useful for every customer. And many customers are probably buying hardware that they're not ever going to use simply because we don't use this accelerator instruction or we don't use this accelerator block. And that's, I think, the real story here is that these companies are putting together custom processors that do only the things that they want these chips to do. Over time, this is going to accelerate. Over time, we're going to see people putting out not just a an ARM Neoverse V2 chip, they're going to put out an ARM chip or maybe a RISC-V chip that has specific silicon that does specific things that they specifically designed the chip to do. And I think that that overall is going to increase the efficiency of cloud data centers. It's also going to increase the service for end users. And when it comes to things like tensor processing, Google has a lot of experience there. I would not be at all surprised if their chips vastly outperform everybody else doing Google stuff because they were designed to. One more thing caught my eye coming out of Google Cloud Next, and that is a collaboration between Google and Dynatrace. Now, I've been focused a bit on the modern application and cloud space for a while. That means that we end up looking a lot at observability tools and security tools, which I know Tom looks at as well. And folks over on the Futurum side, Paul Nashawaty spends a lot of time talking about observability. This Dynatrace story is a little bit under the radar, but I wanted to bring it up here at the end of our coverage of Google Cloud Next because it's important. Essentially, Google and Dynatrace are working together to bring these tools to market for global enterprise organizations. You know, they're trying to put together a comprehensive observability solution for next generation applications, and they're going to put that right into Google Marketplace. This, to me, is the kind of partnership that we would love to see coming out of these hyperscalers, because it's all well and good. Yes, I know I just enthused about custom silicon and retrieval augmented generation and advanced large language models and stuff. Well, those things are great. But you know what's even better? Developing solutions that customers can basically point and click and deploy that make their everyday users' experience better. And frankly, that's what we're looking at here. So Dynatrace is going to support a range of all the Google Cloud services that people use. They're going to bring benefits in terms of continuous observability and monitoring. And all of this stuff is going to work nicely. It's going to work together. I'd love to see more collaborations like this. We do see more coming out of there. And frankly, Dynatrace is a company that we're going to be keeping our eye on here. So I wanted to call that out. I also want to call out the fact that there's other collaborations and partnerships being announced at these events. And these things often get overshadowed by the highlights, the keynote announcement that Google's developing a chip or something. People forget that down on the show floor, there's, Dynatrace saying, hey, we've got a really useful solution. Check us out.
Well, the good news, Stephen, is that the only thing that doesn't get overlooked here at the Rundown is all of the great stuff that we have coming up that we love to tell you about. So we have our next event happening May 15th and 16th. It's going to be Mobility Field Day. We've already told you about some of the great companies we have joining us like Cisco and Celona and Juniper Networks. But the next one that I want to announce is Ubiquiti. That's right. Ubiquiti is going to be a part of this event. We are excited to have them showing off their new technologies, and they're super excited to talk to our delegates for the very first time. And we have a full lineup of delegates joining us on the website. If you want to check out techfieldday.com, you can see who's going to be there, both presenting and listening and engaging in conversations. And then coming up at the end of the month, you've got a first of its kind event.
That's right. As I mentioned, we're doing a app dev field day. We're pleased to announce that Catchpoint will be there, along with Tech Field Day favorites Mesmo. They gave us a little bit of a preview of their solution. The delegates were so excited. I'm very happy to welcome them back for App Dev Field Day, May 29th and 30th.
And then coming up after that, we are, of course, going to be at Cisco Live US in sunny, somewhat warm Las Vegas, Nevada. We are going to be bringing you live streaming presentations from our friends at Cisco. I'm sure they'll might have an announcement or two during Cisco Live. But we're also going to be hearing from Open Gear. They are a longtime friend of us at Cisco Live and many other events that we do. So we're excited to talk to them and learn a little bit more about the cool stuff that they are working on. And then coming up after that, Stephen, what have we got going on?
Well, we're going to be attending the annual 6.5 Summit remotely. That's a virtual event. And that same week, we're going to be doing Cloud Field Day 20. We've got a half a day sponsored by Juniper. We've got T-Second, which is a company that you might have spotted on our Utilizing Edge podcast. And we've got a couple more that we're going to be announcing real soon now. But the most important thing, like I said, is the 6.5 Summit goes on at that same time. And we're going to have a bunch of crossover stuff between Field Day and 6.5 Summit. Can't wait to bring that to you.
And we can't wait to bring you the next episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown, because remember, we are on every Wednesday afternoon. We have new episodes coming out as the news breaks, and you can watch the replay on YouTube if you are a YouTube fan. If you prefer to listen to us as a podcast, you can just look for the Gestalt IT Rundown in your favorite podcatcher and listen to the audio version of this podcast. You won't get all of our excited eyebrow raising and hand waving, but that's okay. And as these news stories come out, you know, we add them to the list. We love to hear what you think of the news. So make sure you leave a comment or a review or a rating on the podcast. That helps people understand what we're all about around here. We will be back next week with fewer haikus, unless it's sonnet week next week, in which case I'm going to have to get all Shakespearean on you. But until then, for myself, Tom Hollingsworth, for Stephen Foskett, for all of those wonderful people that work behind the scenes to make us look and sound great, thank you very much for tuning in. We will see you next week.